You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Hello, fellas. How are you both?
Not too bad.
Perfectly well, thank you.
Perfectly well. Very perfunctory napalm. Anyway.
Well, listen, we've got obviously lots to talk about in this episode. We've got Paris-Roubaix to pick over the bones of Paris-Roubaix. We'll maybe mention in passing Tour of the Basque Country as well, although our attention was mainly taken up this last week with Paris-Roubaix. Lots to talk about there, obviously. In the final part of this episode as well, we'll hear an interview with Callum Skinner. I'm just saying that so that we remember it, because it feels like it's going to be a long time till we get there. But Callum Skinner, the track sprinter. Daniel looking suitably confused at this. He's a track sprinter. Daniel, he won an Olympic gold medal in the team sprint and a silver medal in the individual sprint. And he is going to the World Track Championships, which start this week in Hong Kong, which Lionel might mention in his news roundup. I don't know. But Lionel, have you got your news roundup?
I have indeed, Rich. Yeah, well, as you say, Paris-Roubaix was the biggest race of the weekend. And it was won in pretty impressive style by Greg Van Avermaet, capping an incredible spring for the BMC rider. He adds Paris-Roubaix to Het Nieuwsblad, the Grand Prix E3 Harelbeke and Gent Wevelgem that he's won. Shouldn't forget also that he was second at Strade Bianche and the Tour of Flanders. So really has been the man of the spring. We'll talk about him in the first part of this podcast, I expect. He outsprinted Quickstep's Zdeněk Stybar. Poor old Stybar faced a real conundrum, didn't he? Because he had his Quickstep teammate Tom Bonan behind. There was no fairy tale finish in the Velodrome for Bonan. He finished in 13th place. Should mention Cannondale's Sebastian Langeveld, who was third, taking the final place on the podium. We'll talk Paris-Roubaix in part one. The rest of the racing, there's been quite a bit of racing going on. Before Paris-Roubaix, a few days before, there was the Schelder Prijs in Belgium, and that was won for a record fifth time by Marcel Kittel. In fact, his fifth win in 6 years. In the Basque Country in northern Spain, five riders went into the final 27-kilometre time trial, tied on time. I can't remember a race, a stage race, being as close as that, coming down to the final stage. Alejandro Valverde, Rigoberto Urán, Romain Bardet, Luis Menkes and Michael Woods were all level on time, with Alberto Contador 3 seconds back. The time trial sorted it all out, though, and Valverde continued his amazing Spanish spring by winning overall, consigning Contador to yet another second place. That means Valverde has won the Tour of Murcia, the Ruta del Sol, the Volta a Catalunya, and now the Tour of the Basque Country so far this season. Other standout rides there, Primoz Roglic of Lotto Enel Jumbo won a stage in Bilbao, as well as that final time trial. Another rider who's had an impressive spring, albeit at a slightly lower level, is the Frenchman Lilian Calmejean. He's won the Circuit de la Sarthe for Direct Energy, following his win at the Coppi e Bartali a few weeks ago and the Étoile de Bessèges at the start of the season. Alex Dowsett of Movistar won the time trial there, and friend of the podcast Brian Cockard won 2 sprint stages. A couple of wins for young riders that people may be familiar with or not. Ireland's Eddie Dunbar won the under-23 Tour of Flanders, and Britain's Tom Pidcock won the junior Paris-Roubaix in the Velodrome just a few hours before the main event. Off the bike, the big news this week, Fabio Aru of Astana is out of the Giro d'Italia with a knee injury following his crash in training early this month. That means he's going to missed the start of the race, which is on his home island, Sardinia. A big shame for Aru, but probably we'll see him at the Tour de France now.
Big shame for the cycling podcast as well, Napalm, because I'd prepared a special Kilometre Zero episode on Sardinia and Aru, which is now going in the bin.
Can it not just be about Sardinia?
It could do with a bit of jiggery pokery. Also, Napalm, I thought you might mention the US Masters in the news roundup this week.
Oh, yeah.
You could find some connection.
Wrong podcast, Daniel.
Daniel Freeb's nemesis, Justin Rose, defeated by Sergio Garcia in the Masters. How do you feel about that, Daniel?
Hang on, nemesis. Daniel is his nemesis, exactly.
Correct. Well, someone asked me, Napalm, whether I'd had a bet, because I was talking a bit about betting at the weekend. talking about Paris-Roubaix, didn't have any success there, but someone asked me on Twitter whether I'd had a bet on Justin Rose at the Masters, and I said no, because I still consider him a rival.
Talking of betting, I had a fairly tidy sum on Stibar, which meant that I was up out of my seat as they came into the velodrome, cursing Stibar, making a bit of a hash of the finale there. Could have.
Well, that's a good starting off point for Paris-Roubaix discussion, is it not? Okay, so you would have celebrated a Stibar victory, Lionel, but I suggest that a lot of people wouldn't. What did we make of Stibar's tactics? I mean, he said in post-race interviews that it was all for Tom Bonin, his teammate. But nevertheless, he was in that three-man leading group with Langeveld and Van Avermaet, and he did not a tap. He sat on the back, which is very, very bad etiquette. Okay, fair enough if you're not then going to contest the sprint, but, you know, he did, and he came very close to winning the race. What did we make of that?
I think it's fair enough, isn't it, Rich? All's fair in love and war, and races like Paris-Roubaix. I mean, he had Boonen behind. I think it was fair, and he'd also done an awful lot of work. He'd tried to attack on a number of occasions between about the 40-kilometre mark or 40-kilometre-to-go mark and 20-kilometres-to-go mark. I mean, I initially looked at the way Quickstep had ridden and thought they'd got it wrong, in the sense that if we're familiar with the terms, I think, zonal marking and man-to-man marking in football, and I thought that Quickstep had gone for a zonal approach, i.e. they'd decided that Stibar was going to go with any attacks between, well, in a certain at a certain point of the race, so between about 40 kilometres to go and 20 kilometres to go. And I thought that was the wrong thing to do. I thought they should have divided it up, that Boonen followed the A-listers, so he followed Van Avermaet, Degenkolb, so forth and so forth, and Stibar should have been the guy going after anyone else, because really, you know, tactics in cycling are all about creating advantages. You know, you've got to preserve the advantage you think you've got at a certain point in the race, and any situation that is not to your advantage, you have to try to take the momentum out of brakes or whatever. That's what it looked like, that they'd got that wrong, that Stibar was the wrong guy to go with Van Avermaet. Of course, the reality was that Tom Boonen, I think, was not on a particularly good day, and he said that after the race. So didn't really have much choice. Stibar was the stronger rider, and he's quite a quick rider, not as quick as Van Avermaet on this occasion, but I thought they played it okay, and it seems a bit churlish to criticize a team. I mean, I just did a quick tot up of podium positions in this sort of spring classics campaign, a cobbled classics campaign, in the sort of seven major cobbled classics. I didn't count Skelder Price because it's so different, but Quickstep had seven podiums, and only nine World Tour teams didn't have a single podium finish in those seven cobbled classics. So Quickstep have obviously done pretty all right.
Yeah, I think they played the hand that they ended up being dealt, and I think the problem was that the Bonin group was, you know, it was hanging in the balance whether they would come back, and there was so many of them that perhaps if you looked at the numbers, if they got organized behind a bit better, it might have come back. In the end, it was pretty close, and it almost all came together in the velodrome itself. Certainly the Gianni Moscon group just about got onto the back of the Van Avermaet Stibar group in more or less the back straight, more or less the finishing straight. But the Bonin group was just that little bit too close, I think, and it gave them the conundrum and persuaded Stibar and Quickstep that sitting on was probably the smart tactic. You can't really blame him for that. But there, you know, then when it came to the to the velodrome, he probably would have been a pretty unpopular winner had Van Avermaet not come round the top just in the approach to the line. And if he had won it and been an unpopular winner, you could have understood that as well. Not unpopular for me, though, because I would have had 80 or 90 quid.
I'm a bit more hard line on this than you, Per, are. I think you go through, you do your turn, and you don't necessarily... you don't necessarily give it everything, but you go through and you don't just sit on the back and then attack them in the velodrome.
You do what you need to do. And you know, it's to Van Avermaet's great credit that it didn't, he didn't let that faze him. And I think this is something I was going to go on to say later when we talk about Van Avermaet, but the hallmark of his fantastic spring has been this lack of hesitation, this lack of sort of politics that we often see holding breaks up and holding moves up. You know, guys look at their breakaway companion and say, why aren't you working? And they keep a sort of mental balance sheet of who's doing more work and whose interests are what. Van Avermaet has been absolutely fabulous in the way that he has just been so decisive and so committed every time he's decided that it was time to go and time to try and win a race.
And let's not forget that on Sunday he did have quite a lot of misfortune. He had a problem with his stem. I think he was adjusting his stem before the Arenberg Forest. This was over 100 kilometers still to go, and then he was caught up in a crash, and at one point we saw him running the opposite way down the course in a state of real panic. And that all happened before Arenberg, and he was off the back going through there, although the group was coming back together. And so at that point, I wouldn't have put an awful lot of money at all on Van Avermaet. But one of the things that stuck with me making the Matt Heyman podcast recently about his victory last year was this phrase that he kept repeating, in which he tells his young teammates, keep riding, Paris-Roubaix especially, keep riding. And, you know, that was certainly Van Avermaet's motto, I think, on Sunday as well. He just kept plugging away and, you know, got in a decent group behind the Bonen group. I thought Bonen was maybe too aggressive too early. He was really trying to break things up a lot on some of the cobbled sections, you know, Arenberg and around there, 100 kilometres or so to go. And he perhaps, although he said he wasn't on a great day, perhaps that was because he just did a little bit too much, a little bit too early.
Just on Stibar, Rich, sorry. I get where you're coming from in that you would expect a rider in a three-man group, you know, possibly to go through and do something. I think Stibar did do that. Van Avermaet was waving his arms a fair bit, particularly on the run-in to the velodrome, probably as much to make the point public as anything. But at the end of the day, these races, you know, this is the last one of the series of races, and everyone's aware that you reap what you sow. And so if Stibar and Quickstep, you know, absolutely stitch somebody up by sitting on, then that gets repaid at some point down the road. There is the law of the jungle does come into play at some point. And so in that sense, I'm going to side with Daniel and say that, you know, out on the road, everything is fair game, if, you know, with, as long as it's, you know, within the rules. And, you know, if he could justifiably say, look, I'm sitting on because I've got Bonen behind, you know, fair play to him. It didn't work. And, you know, you can argue that he didn't deserve to be rewarded with a massive victory for the way he rode. But at the end of the day, he's got his team interests to look after.
I take the point. And I take the point as well that, you know, Van Avermaet and Langeveld are under no obligation to ride. If they've got somebody with them who's not working, then they're not obliged to commit fully to the break either. I thought on the approach to the velodrome that Van Avermaet was getting quite antsy with Stibar, getting quite irritated, quite frustrated, probably quite worried. And I felt that the guy who could take advantage of that was Langeveld. And it's very easy sitting on the sofa watching it on television to, you know, be saying, oh, that guy should attack. I mean, no idea what sort of state he was on. He rode a fantastic race, I should say that. I mean, really, I thought Cannondale Drapac rode a phenomenal race. Dylan Van Barlow was very good as well, considering they were missing their two big men for that race, Taylor Finney and Sepp van Marck. But Langeveld, I felt, and this is completely understandable, but he was riding for the podium, wasn't he? And I thought in the velodrome, he was very hesitant, and he didn't. There was a moment where he flicked inside, where he was looked like he was thinking about jumping, and it was just at the moment Gianni Moscon jumped, and he came back up. He and Jasper Stuyven made contact again with the leading three, and Moscon did exactly the right thing and just went for it. And he kind of hesitated a little bit because Langeveld also seemed to be thinking about it at the same time and got in the way of Moscon a little bit. How would we have felt? I think it would have been an amazing thing for Moscon, age 22, to win the race. But there would have been something to celebrate in that, I think, no?
Possibly. I mean, I would have celebrated the fact that he's a tractor fanatic, and this always tickles me greatly.
I'd have celebrated the fact
you
that I tipped him.
Won.
I tipped him as a dark horse last week, the outsider. So,
yeah.
Just to go back to what you were saying about Langeveld, though, Rich, and this theme of hesitation. I think it's been it's always a theme in cycling, particularly in one-day races when moves are going down the road and the riders have to make split-second decisions. But I think it has been a theme of the spring. I mean, I mentioned it at Milan-San Remo. I said that at the top of the pod, Joe, it's often been said that there was a certain amount of time, a certain gap that you needed in order to win. And I sort of said, and I thought the race proved this year that what was the key factor was the lack of hesitation. I think it was the same with, or it's been the same with Van Avermaet on numerous occasions in this spring campaign. And it was interesting to see Dirk De Mol, the Trek Segafredo director sportif, talk after Paris-Roubaix. Trek are one of the teams that have really not had a particularly fruitful spring. And he talked about how this hesitation had really compromised the team's spring campaign. They'd had riders Degenkolb and Stuyven on reasonable form at decent or at various points in the spring, but it's just that moment of trying to second guess things, trying to maybe extrapolate from situations, and just those few seconds can be crucial, particularly in a race like Paris-Roubaix, where there really is no chance often to come back. You know, someone goes away on a cobbled section and you might not see them again. And also one thing watching Paris-Roubaix on Sunday that struck me, and I said this to Lionel actually on Sunday, was it's so refreshing to see a race where no one seems to know exactly what they're doing. It's like taking a room full of architects and throwing them into a tree surgery symposium. You know, everyone's sort of reference points and everyone's sort of understanding of how to ride bike races is really, it's sort of raised to the floor. No one seems to know exactly how the race is going to pan out, and that's what makes it so fascinating.
Especially because it was a race that played out in quite an unusual way. There was no real break to talk of in the early part of the race. We saw all of that on the TV because Eurosport broadcast from start to finish. So the set pattern of seeing that break go, and then there being that little bit of a little bit of calmness behind because there is a group up the road. That was completely absent when they were heading towards the cobbles at Trois-Villes. There was a little move that went away shortly before those first sections of cobbles. Yellow Wallace and Mikel Delage, I think it was, and then Stijn Vandenberg went across to them. But it wasn't a race that really had any set pattern, possibly because the tailwind made it fast. And I think the most interesting section of the race was in that sort of the sort of penultimate act, really. By the time they got to the final act, possibly because it was so fast, I think Seb Piquet tweeted to say that the first 3 hours they averaged 47 kilometres an hour, and over the course of the race it's the fastest ever edition of Paris-Roubaix. It could well be that everybody was just running on fumes by the time the real sort of, the last 20 kilometres came up to them, because really the final kind of major bits of action were on Monzon-Pevel, which is quite a long way from the finish. And after that, everybody almost sort of settled into their groove and seemed to settle for whatever group they were in on the road.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoy, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science and Sport. I think the biggest change in nutrition was the implementation of protein into all athletes' diets. And in the early days, when I first started, it was the domain of the sprinters, the power athletes, purely the longer distance guys, the endurance athletes. And you look at it now, and I think not just in sport, but across the board, everybody is aware of the importance of protein in staying lean, of maintaining lean muscle mass, repair, maintaining that positive nitrogen balance, which is so important. And it's also about the quality of your food and the quality of the ingredients of the food you eat. If it's supplementation, making sure it's trusted, a trusted company that know what they're doing, that you can get something that you're going to know there are no contaminants in there. You're putting your reputation on the line as a professional athlete. So I think in the last 20 years, protein, the quality of the produce that we're getting, and just the awareness, the general awareness has definitely gone up. People are better educated. It used to be these days of the odd person would anecdotally have a thing they would eat, something that, you know, you would think that's ridiculous, why would you want to eat that particular thing? But because they won a few medals, then it almost said, well, if he can do it, I can do it that way too. Instead now, I think if you really want to get to the top, you have to eat the best possible food and have the best possible supplementation at the right time.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsor, Science in Sport. Very grateful to them. We heard a little bit there from Chris Hoy telling us about protein. Chris Hoy, who'll be at the World Track Championships this week, I think he's part of the BBC commentary team. A reminder that if you want to get 20% off any Science and Sport products, go to the website scienceandsport.com, enter the code CPOD20, that's CPOD20, and that will get you 20% off all products that aren't part of any kind of existing offer. So well worth it. Very grateful to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast throughout 2017, which is allowing us to go to all three Grand Tours once again. Giro coming up very soon. We'll no doubt be talking about that in the next couple of weeks. But we're going to carry on talking about Paris-Roubaix, and it's amazing that we've got this far without actually mentioning Daniel Oss.
Or Peter Sagan.
Although, I mean, we talked last week about Tour of Flanders, about how Quick-Step, you know, took that race by the scruff of the neck, were on the front foot, placed riders in the move. That was a great advantage to Greg Van Avermaet, who, once he'd clawed his way back after his various misfortunes, seemed to have Daniel Oss up the road all the time. You know, he was away initially with Stuyven, was clearly stronger than him in that move. And, you know, there's Stuyven finishing fourth on the day, and you wonder what a rider like Daniel Oss could do riding for himself. He very much wasn't. You know, he was, once Stuyven and he were caught, he went again carved out quite an advantage on his own, which really, you know, that was a significant moment in the race. It was heating up behind Van Avermaet, just had that little bit of security, having a man up the road and obviously the excuse not to get involved in any chasing at that point, able to follow moves. And when that move that he was in bridged up to Daniel Oss, he just tapped him on the rear, which some interpreted as a thank you, but actually was just telling him to empty the tanks and do what he could. And he managed to do a lot in over the next few kilometres, and a really significant player in the race, and a phenomenal ride by Daniel Oss. Not just great hair, but good legs as well.
Yeah, it was very important, Rich. But I mean, sometimes you see moves like that, or you see domestiques go off the front, and then, you know, their team leader wins later, and they thank them, and they say so and so did an unbelievable job. You sit down to really analyze it, and you actually wonder. You really wonder what material effect the domestiques' attack had on the outcome and why it was so helpful. In this case, I think it was really important because there was a danger with about 40 kilometres to go of the group featuring Boonen and Stieber and Van Avermaet really slowing and really looking at each other, and the much bigger group behind with the likes of Arnaud Démare and other fast riders. I think Christoph was in there coming back. And what Oss being down the road did was ensure that they had to get a move on, basically, because no one wanted that to happen. No one wanted all of those riders to come back. And the other thing I think it did was it forced a few riders to, again, you know, they were slightly anxious about Oss and they couldn't mess around. And a few of them were thinking this could be the decisive move if we don't do something about it. So guys like Langeveld and Van Baal were having a look and they were accelerating. Ultimately what that allowed Van Avermaet to do when the decisive move went on the car for De Laube was to kind of, again, go off the front in a fairly discreet, unostentatious manner, which has been another hallmark of his riding this spring. I think he's benefited from the fact there's been so much focus on Sagan, and both the teams and the media have been so focused on Sagan that, you know, and also when he does attack, when he does make his move, he's never, you know, putting it in the big ring and going off at 55 kilometers an hour and really drawing attention to how strong he is. Really, he tends to sort of just slip away. And that was what happened on Sunday. And then, of course, Os managed to pull out another 3 or 4 kilometres and contributed in a second way. So, it was a phenomenal performance by him.
Yeah, he's an understated personality, Greg Van Avermaet, isn't he? And he rides in an understated way. I thought he was very understated in victory too. Considering this was his first monument, you know, he's been knocking on the door for a few years. I've seen people look happier at winning a big race like that.
BMC's first monument as well. The team really stepped up in 2010. They were mainly an American domestic team before that. But in 2010, they signed a lot of riders, spent a lot of money primarily at first on classics riders and had never won a monument until Sunday.
I've got nothing to say about Daniel Os other than that his hair was magnificent, sticking out from the back of his helmet. And, you know, just the way he did do that last little effort. You're right, Daniel, it was about 3.5-4 kilometres. And, you know, he'd done so much earlier in the race, but he still had just that little bit extra to give. And we're talking about what Stibar was trying to do for Bonen behind. You know, Van Avermaet did benefit from having Os there. You know, that gave him just those crucial few kilometres of, you know, just the pressure relieves on him, really knowing that he's got somebody else doing the legwork for him.
Paris-Roubaix, it is like bare knuckle fighting. It's not really like tree surgeons, or was it architects doing tree surgery or tree surgeons doing architecture? I can't remember. It's so raw and it's so different to see every rider, you know, poking his nose in front at some point or other in the race. And we even saw sprinters like André Greipel, Arnaud Démare at one point, quite an ill-advised move trying to get across to a break. And those guys were up there at the end. I mean, it was odd the way it all sort of almost came back together again towards the end, and a big old group behind the leaders. But of that group, Arnaud Démare, my dark horse, I'll remind you, won the sprint. He was 6th. André Greipel, but just behind him, Degenkolb down in 10th. I mean, Démare and Greipel had left quite a lot on the cobbles, I would suggest, because both of them were quite active all day. You can't hide, can you, in Paris-Roubaix? And that's one of the great things about it.
It's not just that you can't hide, Rich. It's going back to what Daniel was saying about how all convention goes out the window and nobody knows anything, because a puncture or a crash can happen at any time. And so you, in most races, it's about measuring when to expend energy, trying to save as much energy as you can for the finish. But think about Van Avermaet's ride. You know, he wouldn't have been banking on having the problems he had early on in the race. And probably at the time, he may have been cursing his luck, thinking, well, I've just wasted energy here, chasing back on, trying to get back up through the groups after having successive problems in quite quick succession as well. And yet, when you come to look at the race after it's all done and dusted, you would definitely take Van Avermaet's bad luck at his point in the race, still with, you know, 100 plus kilometres to go, than Sagan's trouble with, what, 32 kilometres to go when, or whatever time, you know, it was certainly in the last 40 kilometres. When, if you have bad luck at that moment, it's race over. And so there's not the same, you know, having teammates to work for you is at once it's so advantageous, as Van Avermaet found having Os. But if you're on your own and you're having to do work yourself, it's also not necessarily the sort of the death knell for your chances. I saw a few people on Twitter asking why Bonen would choose to, in inverted commas, waste energy by stretching it out on the cobbles. Well, because you seek to turn the screw and gain some advantage when you can. And unlike, you know, it's not like a road race where just riding on the front is costing you more energy. It's not as significant in a race like Paris-Roubaix as it might be in another one-day race.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that, Lionel. It was nonetheless slightly disappointing and anticlimactic not to see Tom Boonen win. I mean, he's not the first rider to attempt this sort of swan song. I remember Franco Ballerini ending his career at Roubaix, and again, everyone hoped that there would be this fantastic grand finale to his glittering Paris-Roubaix career, and it didn't happen. But, you know, as I said earlier on, Quickstep have had a pretty fantastic Cobble Classics campaign, you know, 7 podiums, Second only really to Van Avermaet and BMC. But there are a lot of teams that have not really reaped very much at all from this Classics campaign. You know, you think of Trek Segafredo, again, have not really, well, have not ridden poorly, but don't have much to show for certainly their investment this winter. You know, they spent a lot of money on John Degenkolb. They've got Stuyven. They've got a lot of strong riders, actually. I think they'll be a real force in the years to come, but not a great Classics campaign for them. Sky as well. Lotto NL, we saw nothing from them. And Lotto Soudal as well, of course, the big other big Belgian team alongside Quickstep. One half of the Belgian old firm were really, well, I don't know whether they were unlucky or just didn't perform, but didn't even place a rider on the podium in any of those seven important cobbled classics. Thijs Benoot really got his spring wrong or didn't find the form that he wanted to find. And Jürgen Rolands was prominent for a while at Paris-Roubaix on Sunday, but otherwise not much from them either. So there are quite a few teams who have really failed in their Classics campaign and are under quite a bit of pressure now going into the Ardennes and going into the sort of the major tour season.
Hey, it's Elena Cecchini, rider from Canyon's Run team, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. So I ride because cycling is my job and also my love. I started as a young rider when I was 6 and it became my bigger passion. My worst ride is, if I can say a race, is Flèche Wallonne, because I really hate Mur de Huy. I know it's a really iconical race, but it takes everything out of me every year. So I always hope to not have it in the calendar, but just to say also this year I will race it.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to our main sponsor, Rafa. You heard there from Elena Cecchini, the rider on Canyon SRAM, telling us how much she hates the Mur de Huy. The Mur de Huy obviously will feature in Flèche Wallonne next week as we move into the Ardennes Classics. We're going to talk about them in a moment. But she rides for Canyon SRAM. Of course, they wear Rafa clothing. And we're very grateful indeed to Rafa for sponsoring us. We've got a couple of events coming up. Lionel and I are doing an event in London with Paul Voss. That was for friends of the podcast and members of the Rafa Cycling Club. Unfortunately, the tickets went within half an hour of being made available this morning. I'm speaking on Tuesday morning or Tuesday afternoon. They went immediately. So apologies if you tried to get a ticket for that. We'll be doing more events coming up. And in fact, I'm doing an event on the 25th of April with Orla Shinoui and Lizzie Dagnan, formerly Lizzie Armitstead, in Leeds, at Waterstones in Leeds. You'll find that if you Google Waterstones Leeds. I think tickets are still available for that. I'm also doing an event a couple of nights later in Manchester with Hannah Barnes and other members of the Canyon SRAM team. That's on the eve of the Tour of Yorkshire. So that's the 27th of April at the Rafa Cafe in Manchester. And we're going to be doing more events coming up over the next few weeks and months. I think we're going to be doing an event on the day of the Nocturne race in London, again with Rafa. So we'll give you details of that nearer the time. Just on the, before we sort of look ahead to the Ardennes races and then hear our Callum Skinner interview, which is actually very interesting. Callum Skinner covers a lot of ground from the Fancy Bears hack. He was one of the riders whose details were hacked, to all the recent stories at British Cycling, etc. It's interesting stuff. But on the Basque Tour, I watched quite a lot of the Basque Tour, actually. Yeah, Contador second again, Valverde first again. A couple of talking points. I mean, Samuel Sanchez had a terrible crash. Looked like he might be about to win stage four of the Queen's stage, and came off on a corner. Don't exactly know what happened, but he came down very, very heavily indeed and actually needed surgery following that. So he was in a bad way. Valverde won that stage. It was another bit hesitation, I felt, on the part of Cannondale. Drapac. They had Michael Woods and Rigoberto Urán up there. Urán had a chance, I think, to win that stage. And again, easier said than done. But Valverde was the guy that took probably greater risks in quite a dangerous but thrilling run into the finish. And he won the stage. He is the sort of the cannibal this year. He just gobbling up races left, right, and centre. Another talking point was the final time trial. Lionel, you mentioned that in your news roundup that five riders began that on the same time. It began with quite a big climb, and Contador was the only rider who started, or the only favourite certainly, who started it on a road bike and then changed to a time trial bike at the top of the climb. He was the quickest through all the early time checks by quite some distance, but faded, and Valverde snatched the win there. So I don't know. I mean, Contador's form seems a little bit. He's not going as well as Valverde, basically. And this, you know, this is the year. This could be his final year. It's all about the Tour de France. But Valverde will be riding the Tour as well. And on the form that he's on, he's 37 years old. But at some point, you're going to say, well, he's looking very, very good. We don't want to go on a digression about Alejandro Valverde and what his form might mean or otherwise, but it's you know, he is looking as good, as strong as he has ever looked, I think, at the moment. He's in fantastic shape, and Basque Tour, I was there last year, of course, at the Basque Tour, remember? I did a little report from there, and it's always a nice race to watch. We're going to talk about the Ardennes Classics as well, chaps. Finally on the Basque Tour, and it links to the Ardennes Classics, but we're hearing that Julian Alaphilippe, who was very unlucky there and had at least one crash, but he's got a knee injury that's going to keep him out of the Ardennes Classics, so removes one of the three potential leaders from the Quick-Step lineup. But yeah, we've got the Ardennes Classics coming up. Amstel Gold, it's an annual debate. Is it an Ardennes Classic? No.
No. Who said that? Lionel.
No, well, it's not an annual debate. There's one simple answer. It's not in the Ardennes.
Okay.
Quite simple.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I should mention that also this year, there's been for several years a women's Flèche Wallonne. There'll be a new women's Amstel Gold race and a new women's Liège-Bastogne-Liège the following week. Does raise a question again of why there isn't a women's Paris-Roubaix, especially when there's a men's junior Paris-Roubaix, which Lionel mentioned in his news roundup. Christian Prudhomme was asked why there wasn't a women's Paris-Roubaix and gave a pretty unsatisfactory answer, I thought. I think it's within the power of ASO to start that, and perhaps that campaign will gather momentum over the next weeks and months.
Yeah, just going back to Amstel, Rich, the route, of course, has changed this year. No Kooiberg, well, the Kooiberg is still on the route, but it's the sixth of 27 climbs. It used to be the final climb. It was until a few years ago where the race actually finished on top of the Kooiberg. Then the finish line was moved a couple of kilometres further down the road. That didn't really produce the desired effects. Amstel has always been a fairly unpopular classic outside of Holland. Very popular with the Dutch, but not so much with a wider audience. And yeah, the final climb on, is it Saturday or Sunday? That's also moved around over the years, hasn't it? Whether it's on a Saturday or Sunday. But it is going to be the Kooiberg, which used to be the penultimate climb, I think I'm right in saying. And the summit of that is about 3 kilometres from the finish line. I'm just looking now. I think 3.2 kilometres from the finish line. So, and it's a proper descent. The finish line last year was really at the end of more of a sort of false flat after the Kooiberg. This is a real, well, it's not a steep descent, but it is a descent. So that will probably change things slightly. Just looking at the start list, Valverde is obviously going to be a big favourite. Philippe Gilbert, of course, after his incredible classics, well, cobbled classics campaign, is going to be a big favourite too. I think Brian Cockard will go quite well. Obviously more of a sprinter, but a sprinter who's versatile, who can get over climbs. I think he will be a danger in Amstel. It's a race he's very motivated for. And also Direct Energy, just looking at their team, they're also fielding Lilian Calmejan. You talked about Valverde being the cannibal of the Spanish stage race season so far. Well, Calmejan has been a bit of a cannibal himself. He's won Étoile de Bessèges, Circuit de la Sarthe, Settimana Coppa Bartali in Italy. So very interested to see what he's capable of doing at Amstel as well.
Well, Amstel is on Sunday. Van Avermaet is riding Amstel as well, isn't he? It's the only one of the three classics coming up, not Ardennes classics, but the three very similar types of races that are coming up. He is riding Amstel, and with his record and his form of recent weeks, who would bet against him there?
And I'm always quite intrigued and surprised to see Peter Sagan skip Amstel. I would suggest that he is someone who could get over the climbs, 27 climbs in Amstel, as I said. They're not easy, and some of them are very steep. But I think when you think of some of the riders who have thrived in that race, done well in that race before, Oscar Freire didn't win Amstel, but he was a similar kind of rider to Amstel, to Sagan. Used to go fairly well there. Eric Zabel won Amstel once. So, yeah, it's a curious decision, I think, not to field Sagan, but oh yeah.
Well, this is all highly speculative, isn't it? But certainly the absence of Julian Alaphilippe from these upcoming three races does kind of rob them of one of the key dimensions, I think. It's not as if Quickstep haven't got other options, particularly for Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Dan Martin, of course, a past winner there. But I think, you know, it's very, very hard to look past Valverde and Gilbert at the moment, particularly for Flesh Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I mean, both got such pedigree in those races, and both on very, very good form. It could well be a case of sort of three quite repetitive outcomes in terms of the riders that fill the sort of top dozen places. We shall see. I mean, thinking of the Amstel Gold Race has at least changed. You mentioned Brian Coquard, Daniel, people like Michael Matthews, Sonny Colbrelli, just sort of wild cardy riders that might well prosper there. Let's not forget Enrico Gasparotto won last year, didn't he, which was a surprise. Probably the Amstel Gold Race is the most intriguing of the three in terms of the types of riders we might see contesting for the victory. I mean, Colbrelli and Gasparotto both on the same team, of course, now, aren't they? Bahrain Merida, so they're probably looking pretty strong.
Well, I'm off to Flesh Wallonne next week with Orla Chinoui. We're going to be recording the next cycling podcast, Femina, from there, and we'll be doing some stuff for the regular podcast there as well. So that'll be coming at you next week, Flesh Wallonne on Wednesday. Always a great race to go to. So that's all coming up. We've still got Callum Skinner interview to play. Is there any other business before then? Just briefly, a story that we've obviously been following closely, British Cycling and Team Sky. We understand, or it's been reported today, that the report, independent inquiry into the accusations of bullying at British Cycling and discrimination, that has been put back now until May. It's been in draft form for a while now, and it's been going to the various parties who've got a right to respond. It's become clear that an awful lot of people have not contributed at all to that, weren't interviewed for it. None of the endurance track riders from the Rio Olympic Games took part in that, so no Bradley Wiggins. Jo Roussel spoke as well about, you know, making her opinions heard now, but didn't take the opportunity to go and speak to the panel. I understand that not all the riders even received the email inviting them to do so. So there seem to be some real gaps in that, and I think that's causing some problems for UK Sport, who commissioned it. The other big investigation that's been ongoing has been the UK anti-doping one into Team Sky, and particularly the Jiffy bag that was transported out to the Dauphiné. I understand that will come out very soon, like in the next week or so. It's the report is imminent, and we wait to see what that says. I've been, as I'm sure lots of you have, I know you have, Lionel, been listening to the podcast S-Town, which was released all in a oneer, I think seven episodes. A really intriguing tale in America of a man and a town. And what's fascinating about it is that you think you know the story, but you realise that you haven't actually heard all the actors, all the players, and when you do hear from certain other people involved in it, it shows things in a completely new light, and you it challenges all the ideas that you thought you had about it. And I think this is quite similar in some ways to this Team Sky story. We haven't heard from all the people involved in that. Richard Freeman, for example, the doctor, who has not said a word other than in some written answers to the Department of Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. But he's been instructed right from the start of this not to speak about it. So we haven't heard his side of things at all, and it'll be interesting when the UCAD investigation finally ends to hear what he has to say. Any other business, chaps?
Well, Rich, we had the news of Fabio Aru's injury. He crashed about a week ago in the Sierra Nevada. He was at an altitude training camp. He'd been there with his couple of Astana teammates, and he had a blowout on a descent. His tire popped and he crashed, and he's got a very badly swollen knee now and cartilage damage. And he was in, I think he went to Milan on Monday for checks and scans, and so he came back from Spain and went to Milan. Ciro Scognamiglio was there. Ciro, who actually, when I spoke to him earlier today, I said, Ciro, where are you? And he said, I'm on Pozzato, which was slightly alarming, but not altogether surprising. But then I said, what? You're on Pozzato? You're on Filippo Pozzato? And he said, no, Pozzano. Pozzano, it's my favorite beach. Pozzano is a beach outside Naples, where Ciro, of course, is from. Ciro was with Aru yesterday at the clinic in Milan, and he said that Aru is absolutely distraught, as you can imagine, to have to miss the Giro d'Italia. He'll be distraught as well to miss our Sardinian special that we were preparing on him and Sardinia. And he's now going to ride the Tour de France. I know that a couple of people, there were people at Astana who thought that maybe they could have left it a little bit longer to see whether there was, you know, any chance of a dramatic improvement in the next couple of weeks. I think Alexander Vinokourov, the manager of Astana, thought that was not wise and they should immediately redraw Aru's plans for the rest of the season and send him to the Tour de France. Another bit of news, Rich, or something that we've learned in the last few days. Mark Cavendish has been absent from races over the last few weeks. He had an Achilles problem that surfaced at Tirreno Adriatico. Then he didn't ride well in Milan-San Remo. Cavendish also went a couple of weeks ago or a few days ago, he went to have his quarterly blood test. All the riders have to have quarterly blood tests. It's part of the UCI's health monitoring program. What these tests showed up was that Cavendish was actually ill, and he then underwent further tests. I think his team ordered further tests, and they have discovered that he's been suffering from the Epstein-Barr virus, which is more commonly known as glandular fever. And this is obviously very bad news. We've seen riders, heard riders suffering from this virus before, and it tends to keep them away from races for not just a few weeks, but months. Spoke to Cavendish at the weekend. He has been told that he's allowed to ride his bike, but he's not to go over 110 beats per minute. He's using the heart rate monitor to check on that. And he's really, it's just a waiting game now. He's cancelled all of the races, or he's pulled out of all the races he was supposed to do over the next few weeks. And he was supposed to go to the Tour of California. That's not going to happen now. He still thinks that he could be fit. He will be fit for the Tour de France, but it's going to be tough, and it's a bit of a race against time for him. So he's obviously not had a very happy start to the season. But on the other hand, he's at least relieved, because he was completely bemused by his performance in Milan-San Remo, because in the weeks leading up to Tirreno and San Remo, he thought they'd been flying. He thought they'd been going really, really well. But then the word days where it just wasn't working at all, and he thought that was strange. His team thought it was strange, and now he's finally found out why that was. So at least he's got some clarity now.
Interesting stuff. That is bad news for Mark Cavendish, and hopefully he will recover his fitness. Let's go to our Callum Skinner interview. I was up in Manchester a few weeks ago at the velodrome there. Callum Skinner was one of those people I met. He, as I mentioned earlier, won a gold and a silver medal at the Rio Olympic Games. which was a real breakthrough for him. He's been trying for years to really step up and become part of that team. And, you know, from the World Championships in London to Rio, he really made a big improvement and performed extremely well in Rio. So I was keen to find out from him how he made that step and how he dealt with success in Rio and the aftermath. Not many of the Olympic gold medalists are really racing full on this year. A lot of them are taking a break, but he's one of the few who's decided to really carry on full speed. But we talked about lots of things. I mean, covered a lot of ground. Callum's records were hacked by the Fancy Bears. Some of his TUEs were released, and his response to that was quite unusual in that he released all his medical records. We speak a bit about that. We speak a bit about politics, I suppose, his anger at the Leave EU campaign using his image and his attempts to get them not to do that. He talks quite openly about some of the stuff that's gone on at British Cycling, how that's affected the riders. And he talks about his father, who's gay, and his brother, who's gay. And he did an article about that and with them for the Gay Times after the Olympic Games, which got a big response. And it's really interesting to hear him talk about that and his reasons for doing it, which were perhaps as much for him as for his family. And that's fascinating. He's a fascinating guy. Here he is, Callum Skinner. So, Callum, I probably last spoke to you face-to-face in the track centre in London at the World Championships last year. Mm. And you'd had a bit of a mixed championship because you struggled, I think, in the team sprint. Mm-hmm. And then came good and had a terrific sort of rest of the championships. And when I spoke to you at the end of the championships, you seemed, despite the disappointment of the team sprint, to be fairly confident that you would have time and you'd be able to turn things around in time for the Olympics.
I think a lot of that came from the coaches and Phil and Jason in 1 and 2, that, you know, if I just seem to progress, then there's not much to take away from that. But I think all of us as a collective had seen real encouraging signs moving forward. So yeah, although we got dropped, it was probably the closest I've ever been with Phil being pretty much on world record pace for that opening lap. You know, Jason said he got cut out by the pace that Phil went, and that's the risk with Phil sometimes. He doesn't always perform in training as well as he does in the race. So yeah, it was quite exciting in a way, because we knew that we were getting closer, but I can understand from the outside looking in why it didn't look like it was all there and why it seemed like a huge jump between that and Leo. But for me, I don't see it as a huge jump. It was a whole bunch of little things kind of clicked together, and we eventually kind of got to where we wanted to be.
Nevertheless, there was improvement required from you. I mean, I remember asking you about, you know, in terms of how you rode it, would it not be better for Phil not to blast out quite to the extent they did? And you said, well, it's not up to him to go slower, and it's up to me to go quicker.
Yeah.
So you seemed to, you know, you had a very clear idea in your head of what you had to do.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think that's the only mentality I have to be able to improve myself. I think it's that kind of no-compromise approach. But as a team, we did actually look at gearing Phil up and not slowing him down, but changing the profile of his lap a little bit. But one of my proudest moments was in the final, where he pretty much went as quickly as he did in London, and the team still managed to stay together. So that was like a huge, you know, on top of the medal, on top of the Olympic record and all that kind of stuff, that was a real kind of, you know, high point for me. There was that he went as quick as he did in London. We put those kind of demons to bed and I managed to stay on.
I mean, in Rio, you know, lining up, training obviously had gone well, but huge pressure on you, man three. Mm. Huge pressure. There's always been huge pressure on you, really, with the whole, you know, the next Chris Hoy label that's been attached to you for a long time. How do you deal with that pressure?
Yeah, this is something that everyone kind of said to me afterwards, but I think I was just so focused on the job in hand that it was almost kind of robotic and kind of mechanical. It was, you know, I'd been in the position where I'd been dropped before, I'd been in the position where it's gone well before. And to be honest, what I wanted to do most was just to kind of put in a lap that was equal to the reigning Olympic champions at the time, Phil and Jace, and kind of do the boys proud and do the team proud and move forward. But yeah, I think the pressure maybe kind of all came to a head after the games. And that's when you kind of let off that valve and you kind of reflect and you realise how much pressure you were under. I think Chris Boardman messaged me on Twitter privately afterwards saying, you know, like he was really impressed and that he didn't think anyone that night had more pressure on them than me to perform in the Velodrome.
And then you went on from there, you know, to have a terrific run in the sprint as well and get another medal, which must have been a real bonus. Did you enjoy the Olympics?
Yeah, no, hugely. I think everyone enjoys riding a bike race when they're going well, and there's no doubt we were going really well. And I think that's another bit where you don't realise the stress, because you know you've got the form, you've got that newfound confidence, you don't tend to lose many races if you're on that form. And you know, the only races I did lose was against Jason in the final of the sprint.
I mean, can you understand why that happened for the British team again for the third Olympics in a row? Obviously, a lot of other riders from other nations baffled by it. Some of them making sort of dark hints in the press about a sinister reason behind it. But you obviously understand yourself how you got to that position. How do you explain the collective success, the ability of the team to all hit top form at the right time?
It's a tricky one. I think there's a whole bunch of elements. I think it's the same as there's not one magic reason why I improved. There's a whole bunch of little reasons, you know. And I think maybe some of the nations thought, you know, they could capitalize on the upsets that were happening in the team. You know, we lost the performance like 100 days before the games. From the outside looking in, things looked pretty rough. But I mean, I'm fortunate enough to say that wasn't the case inside. You know, we essentially lost one manager and our day-to-day staff, who are incredibly talented at what they do, were still there and still supportive and still as driven to win gold as much as we were. But I'd say what the way that kind of, I mean, in terms of why we do so well at Olympic Games in terms of World Championships, it's that it's almost like a sole focus, and you're kind of, that's kind of drilled into you from a young age. I remember our ODP t-shirt had two Olympic rings in it, and then you'd work up to getting the five. It was always seen as like junior world champs, you know, world championships, world cups. They're always just a stepping stone to getting towards that Olympic goal at the end. And I think that's where the other nations don't have that as much. You know, I see other nations using some of their Olympic kit at world cups, some of their Olympic kit at Grand Prix even. Whereas for us, it's locked away, it's kept as a special occasion, and you know that when it comes to the Olympic Games, that's your time to perform.
What was it like coming back, finding that, you know, things would have changed quite a lot for you in terms of how people would look at you? There were demands on your time, there were, you know, events that you had to go to with your medals and so on. How did you cope with all that? Because I've heard it said a lot in this building in particular that it's not the, you know, it's the dealing with the success can be even harder than dealing with failure.
Yeah, it can be. I think for me, the biggest shift was going from an athlete where if I did get the result, that was probably above expectation. And now I'm in a position where if I don't get the result, that's, you know, they expect the results now because I've performed. And that's a huge shift. It's gone from nothing to lose to having something to lose, I guess. But no, it kind of switched overnight. I think what initially kind of made me a bit hesitant about it was like the Leave EU campaign used an image of me in one of their videos, and I said, you know, thanks politely, please just don't use it because I don't want to be associated with that. And then that ended up with like BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, Eddie Izzard, they tweeted it. It was like 10,000 favourites, 5,000 retweets just overnight. And I've gone from someone, if I tweeted that before the games, no one really would have cared. And now everyone does.
You seem to have been keen to use your new fame, your profile, to stand up and make your voice heard. You know, you've done a few things. You did that photo shoot with your father, who's gay, and your brother. And, you know, that was something that you did where you were presumably aware that, you know, it's very unusual for athletes to contribute to that particular discussion. I mean, what was your thinking behind doing that? Is it that sense that you have that you're going to use your fame, your profile in a positive way?
To be honest, I think the whole dad and my brother thing was more of a personal step. And I think I always said with that one, like with the Olympics, regardless, you know, win, lose, or draw, this was something that I felt as if I'd covered up and needed to have out in the open. And I'm glad that it was so well received. And, you know, people in the building here were saying, oh, we never had any idea. And to me, that also, you know, signified that obviously I'd been hiding something, and it was good to have that out in the open. And again, you know, I know that some people still, especially in sports, some people still struggle with, you know, homosexuality and things like that. So the more that it's out there and the more that people know about it, then hopefully the more steps we can move forward. But yeah, it's not something that I consciously use. I'd say I've always occasionally put a tweet that's a bit out there or talked about, you know, nothing tends to be off limits, particularly if I'm on topics and things like that, you know, whether it's the TUEs or the anti-doping or the homosexuality with my dad or Leave EU, you know, I'm quite happy to offer an opinion. It just seems that it carries a bit more weight now than it used to.
If you express an opinion, you will get, I mean, Gary Lineker is an extreme example, but you'll get a lot of positive reaction, but also some negative reaction. Does that put you off, or are you determined to carry on? You know, just
no. It's something, you know, it's something I wholeheartedly believe is right. So I don't see why I should, you know, not say it. And hopefully, especially with like maybe the homosexuality thing, it makes, you know, hopefully there might be a kid who thinks that sport is a bit of a macho heterosexual environment, and if we can break down that barrier, then that's a good step forward. I don't see why I should be quiet with things like that that I think are for the benefit. And with the Leave EU thing, that wasn't necessarily, I didn't, although later, you know, if you dig through my tweets, you can probably tell which side I'm on. But that tweet to them wasn't necessarily pro or against. It was just basically, you know, don't use my image for to push your campaign. So I tried to keep it as neutral as possible.
You mentioned the TUEs. I mean, you were one of the athletes named in the Fancy Bears hack, and one of the only athletes to respond in the way that you did by basically, it was interesting because it took you a couple of weeks. I think you went off and actually phoned all the hospitals that you'd been to, because you've suffered asthma most of your life, haven't you? You went back to old doctors, specialists, hospitals that you'd been treated in to dig out all your old medical records and then release them. Was that something that you decided to do immediately? And how did it feel to be, you know, to have your name in a story about, you know, athletes taking TUEs, and the way that that was interpreted on people was, it was, you know, it was interpreted as athletes exploiting the rules.
Again, that was something where I felt as if I couldn't really stay quiet. It wasn't always my intention to go public with the records. I think that was, once I heard they were out, that's where I immediately went to getting them so I'd have the option, because, you know, when it comes to data access in the NHS, it's not always the quickest process. But yeah, I felt quite uneasy at the prospect. I think one of the things was, as you know, flicking through Twitter, and there's a slightly unflattering picture of me, and it says Callum Skinner's TUEs released or hacked or whatever. And I was thinking, if I put myself in a cycling fan's shoes, I'm going to go through my home feed, probably not open the article, and then just think, Callum Skinner, dodgy, move on. And that was something that I was keen to try and alleviate, or, you know, try and give people more information to make their mind up, make their minds up, because the TUEs, like, I've got nothing against them being private, but it was maybe something that I'd want to release on my own terms, and this definitely wasn't on my own terms. I was the victim of a hack, and they posted them without any context, without anything, and people were gone wild with this kind of stuff. You know, there's people quoting stuff saying, like, calling them certificates to dope and things like that, which was the Russian agenda that they were pushing on that. So I was quite keen to be as open and as honest as possible, and I think that's why I thought the NHS argument was a really strong argument.
The other issue, Callum, that has been big here, and then we're speaking in the velodrome, has obviously been all the stories about the culture here at British Cycling. You've been part of this system a long time, and you know, you're somebody who's worked up through it. Do you recognise the picture that's been painted in some quarters of the sort of culture here, where there's obviously a huge amount of pressure, but where that pressure can sometimes result in people not being treated well?
Yeah, this whole process has been, you know, quite disappointing, I'd say. You know, there's obviously been the wrongdoing in the past. I think ultimately it seems like it was a management issue, and an issue that there wasn't enough checks and balances over the people that were in charge. And ultimately that would be something that would have had to change eventually anyway. To put it in a bit of perspective, I think the athletes are quite disappointed by this whole thing, because obviously people have behaved in an inappropriate way, and the outcome of that is that there might be you know, some kind of, there's always these threats in the media about cuts to funding and things like that, and you're basically in a position where it seems to be that it's the athletes that are suffering despite having done no wrongdoing. You know, the people who have made mistakes in management or made mistakes on the board or something like that, they're pretty much free to go off and work somewhere else. I think what people don't understand about British Cycling is that it's an elite team, it's not a professional team. The athletes are here and they can't go anywhere else. So if British Cycling loses its funding, that's going to be, you know, disastrous for the whole team, because nowhere else you can go. It's not like when a World Tour team folds and you can move on, or you don't like the culture and you can move on, which brings us back to the bullying thing. You can't run elite sport as if it's a professional team. There has to be a bit of give and take about the culture.
You mentioned inappropriate behaviour, bullying, these sorts of words. Is that something you personally have either experienced or witnessed?
It's not something I've personally experienced or even actually really witnessed. You hear, obviously, there's quite profile public cases, and I would be lying if I was saying I wasn't completely aware of them before. But obviously, when there's rumours, it's a bit difficult to voice that, because it's a bit, you know, this building is a bit like Chinese whispers sometimes. You hear about certain things were said to certain athletes, and, you know, it's not something you can ever act on, really. But no, in terms of personally, I haven't had anything untoward particularly, but I think that's the other thing. You know, elite sport is tough. There's going to be days where, you know, you might have a hard truth and you had to deal with it and you have to move on. But I think that's something that we need to try and hold on to as well, is not to lose our honesty and not to lose what makes us successful. We need to take what makes us successful, keep that, but then also just bring in, you know, a few little changes here and there just to make the team a bit more, you know, open to all people and a bit, you know, not softer, but just a bit more considerate maybe.
Can you beat Jason in Tokyo?
I think there's a history of it, isn't there? So he got silver in Beijing, and then he got gold in London. You know, there seems to be a history of the guy who comes second in the games ends up getting there. But I mean, that's not something to be complacent on. But yeah, no, I think it's something that I'm going to be working on. And I think what I'd really like to see is that we nail the team sprint, and then I get to the point where Jason was, where he's able to focus on the other events. You know, for me, that was, and what's made the silver medal quite sweet actually in the sprint was that the only thing we focused on was team sprint. And that was it. There was no sprint practice. There was no keeling practice. It was just team sprint. So if we're in a position where we can hopefully capitalise on the success we've had, nail that team sprint, we can start to broaden our horizons a little bit and focus on the other events and hopefully pick up those 3 goals.
So that was Callum Skinner. Interesting guy. And be interested to see how he gets on at the World Championships in Hong Kong this week. We'll tell you a little bit about them in next week's podcast, which will come at least in part from the flesh alone. Anything else? Lionel, I think you were going to say something about another little friends bonus.
Yeah, I was, Rich. Just before we go, friends of the podcast, anyone who signed up as a friend of the podcast this year, 2017, it costs £10 for the year. 11 feature-length episodes we're producing at least, aren't we? Three or four of them are out already. I lose track. But we've been doing a few little bonus pieces as well. Last week, we made a little bonus on Tom Bonan just to mark his retirement. You can still listen to that if you sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And before the weekend, I think this is going out on Thursday morning, a little piece I've made, which I'm calling The Hipster's Classic, might appeal to Daniel. It's about the Trobro-Lyon one-day race in Brittany. I was there last year, rode the Cyclo Sportive the day before the race, and it's kind of, having just been at Gent-Wevelgem and seen the plug streets there, the concrete farm roads, this is another race that explores the countryside off the beaten track. It goes across farm tracks, gravelly paths, and sort of what we in the UK would, I guess, call bridle paths, sort of where you might see horse riders going. The sort of place that it's perfectly safe to take a cyclocross bike or a mountain bike, but this is a road race. And we've just got a little piece on that race because it's coming up this weekend. It's actually on Easter Monday this year. And if you like the sound of the race in our episode, I think Eurosport are showing highlights of the race at some point, maybe Monday evening or Tuesday. Check the listings for that.
Great stuff. So that's more stuff for friends of the podcast. Become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. And thanks very much indeed to everybody who has signed up. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you to this week's producer, Adam Bowie, and to Glass Pear for the music that has proved so popular with our listeners. Thanks to Nick Christian and Jonathan Rowe for all their help. Nick does a great job on our weekly newsletter. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you'd like to receive that. And Jonathan does an equally great job helping any friends of the podcast with technical queries. Finally, thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science and Sport, and to our podcasting platform, Audioboom.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.